Welcome very much to the BRC Open Day Debate. Good to share data, research, privacy in the NHS. Thank you for coming. My name is Mark Sheehan. I'm the Oxford BRC Ethics Fellow, and I'm your David Dimbleby, theoretically at least. We'll see how that works. The format of the debate is we have our esteemed panellists here who will have something to say about the questions that we want to ask. But we do want to make this interactive, so we are looking for you to ask questions about things that concern you and about things that you feel our panellists haven't addressed properly. The way in which we'll do that is I'll keep an eye out for you putting your hand up, and then I'll try to fit you in or acknowledge your question, at least acknowledge your question and try to come back to you if I can. So if you could be bear with me. And then Cora and Paul, I believe, are coming around with the mics. If you could speak into the mic very closely, that would be great. Okay. So how patients' data is handled used to be quite simple. 20 to 30 years ago, information about yourself, your medical history, and treatments would be kept in a paper folder and left to gather dust on a shelf. With the advent of computing, in everyday life, everything has changed. Now data can be shared around the world with a single click and put through complex computer programs with other patients' data to analyze trends to support research and ultimately improve patient care. In hospitals, anonymized data has been used for research for many years. So for example, if you spent 4 days in hospital after stroke, that number could be added without your name to all the other length of stays for stroke to study how best to provide stroke care. In some cases, where your name could be accessed, you'll be asked for permission to allow your data to be used for research. You may also remember there was a proposal for GPs to share anonymized data without patients' express consent 2 years ago, which is currently on hold pending the outcome of a review. But the ability to access and share patients' data needs is an issue that, while has excited many people from the medical community, has led to questions and concerns from others. We're hoping this debate will clarify some of these issues and provide some food for thought to help you reach your own conclusions. The aims of today are to think about a number of questions. What are the benefits of sharing data? Should you give your consent for your data to be shared? When should you be asked to give consent for your data to be shared? Who should have access to your data? And is your data safe and secure? Good. So our panelists, I'm very glad to have this group of people assembled here on the stage with me. To my right, far right, is Jim Davies. Jim is the informatics lead for the Oxford NHS Genomics Centre, which was set up in 2014 to lead the government's 100,000 genomes project in Oxfordshire and the surrounding area. He's also the chief technical officer for the 100,000 genomes project nationally. The 100,000 genomes project will involve collecting 100,000 genomes, funnily enough, complete sets of DNA from patients and their families to analyse and better understand some cancers and rare diseases. Also to my immediate right is Martin Landry, Deputy Director of the University's Oxford Big Data Institute, a new facility that's being constructed at the Old Road campus at the Churchill Hospital and is expected to open at the end of the year. The centre will study large amounts of data, including genetic, clinical, imaging and mobile sensor data on hundreds of thousands of NHS patients to help researchers better understand disease. To my immediate left is Federica Luceviera. She's Marie Curie Fellow at the Social Science, Health and Medicine Department at King's College London. Her current project investigates the ethical challenges of digital technologies in healthcare, specifically looking at the mobile apps and personal health records. Currently, she serves as KCL representative in the European Commission Working Group that has the mission to draft guidelines for the assessment of health app quality. And to my far left is Carol Moore. She's the Executive Director of HealthWatch Oxfordshire, a statutory organisation that exists to strengthen the collective voice of patients and the public so that service providers and commissioners listen to what they have to say. They then hold health and social care providers and commissioners to account on how they use public feedback to shape, inform and influence service delivery and design. So if you join me in welcoming them to the stage, that'd be great. Thank you. Right, to begin, it's probably useful, I think, to get on the table our first question and to get some sort of sense of why this interest in data sharing and data use. So I asked Martin if he wouldn't mind starting off by giving us some reasons why we think, what are the benefits for data sharing?
Okay, well, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here. I mean, I think it's worth taking a perspective about what we're trying to do in medicine. I mean, medicine has always been a specialty that tries to balance decisions based on observations and data, along with the sort of personal considerations of preference, need, and choice. And my career to date has actually encapsulated both elements of that. On a Wednesday morning, I see a single patient, one at a time, in the cardiology clinic here in the hospital. The rest of the week, I study large numbers of patients, hundreds of thousands at a time, in order to try and understand causes of disease, treatments for diseases, and how we might prevent disease and improve health overall. If one thinks back, there's a long history of getting good value out of data, disease outbreaks and the effectiveness of vaccination, treatment of blood pressure and cholesterol to reduce heart disease, choice of surgery, radiotherapy or chemotherapy to treat breast cancer, and the safety and hazards of many drugs and other interventions all come from data. Without data and data on large numbers of people, one wouldn't have meaningful information on those important elements of healthcare. I think what has evolved is the new opportunities that have come about by the increasing use of high-throughput technology. Now, perhaps at one level, and Jim will probably argue with this, the lowest technology piece in all of this is the electronic healthcare record. It is traditionally a convert from the paper-based record, which we all recognize, through to simply an electronic enactment of that paper-based record. And so in some ways, many of the issues are very similar to what you would see in paper-based records. But as we go forwards, I think there's much more power to that, in that actually it becomes more feasible to assess standards of care and identify new treatments from those records and enhance that information with the modern innovations. So whole genome sequencing now becoming feasible at large scale. The use of sensor data, accelerometer data, activity monitors, cameras to look at oxygen saturation, heart rate, all these sort of things, and to look at self-reported data and, of course, imaging data, bringing that together. I think our challenge, and I'll just finish here, is really how do we interpret those data and do it so in a responsible way. And what I'd argue is that that needs partnership. It doesn't just need partnership between patients and the people who care for them, although clearly that is absolutely essential. But also, it requires partnership beyond traditional medical science through to into engineering, computer science, high-level statistics, and so on, new technologies, in order to be able to get the best value, and what I mean by that is the best information for patient care out of those data. And doing so in a responsible fashion that maintains trust is, I think, the critical element of this.
Can I ask you, Martin, just so that we have a sort of an example in the forefront of our mind, what would you say is a sort of good example for us to use to sort of think about any of the benefits that the data, the sharing of data is going to give us?
Well, I guess if I think about the use of genetic information for informing the care of patients with congenital forms of heart disease, that would be one example. A second example would be using genetic information to inform the care of particular types of cancer and develop new treatments for cancer. And another would be in chronic disease management. So I run a clinic where a large number of the patients have chronic cardiovascular diseases and many other diseases all at the same time. One patient is one person, it's not one disease. And trying to monitor how well those people are doing, how they improve, how they deteriorate, and how things change over time is one of the crucial elements for that. If I were able to combine the healthcare information I already have across the entire healthcare system, I have to say, with monitoring data, by which I mean data on how much activity people are doing, how they're functioning at home, what levels of blood pressure are really like when they're in the real world, not when they're in my clinic and they've suffered for the hospital car parking system. Those are the sorts of information that would actually inform care. So that chronic disease management is at one level low tech. This is not new medicine, but another level is high tech. This is an entirely new way of conducting medicine.
Great. Jim, did you want to add anything just about the benefits that we need to add? Is there some point?
About the benefits of sharing data?
Yeah.
I think most people can, I mean, we do spend a lot of time quite rightly concerned about the risks, and I'd probably be one of the angriest people in the room about that sort of stuff. I think it's, you know, we're right to be concerned, but we can also be reassured there's a lot going on. When it comes to the benefits, it's not simply, you know, it's great to have the prospect of advances in the science, improvements in the service. Those are pretty obvious, but they can also be personal. I mean, if I would like my, you know, if I end up in cardiology as a patient, I would like whoever is considering my case, and they're all very busy, to have immediate access to every piece of information that might help them make the right call. And that's you know, I'm, and what's more, I want this information properly shared. I want the context shared as well. I want this partnership that Martin's talking about. I want it understood. I mean, and it, you know, I don't want any of it misinterpreted. I want not just a few facts shared. I want, if someone's going to make a decision about whether to give me a drug or not, or some advice to give me, or recommendation about the course of treatment, I want them to have everything that could be relevant. I might not want other people to have that data, but I want Martin, or Keith, or anyone who's going to make a call on my health, I'm trusting them with my life, I want that data in front of them. So.
That sounds a bit selfish, doesn't it? But,
you know. So if I've got this right, then the idea of the data sharing and allowing your clinicians to have all of the data at hand, this, the reason, as I'm, the benefits are going to come from a different set of people having access to and being able to monitor and manage all of your patient data in a way that hasn't happened before or is novel. Is that, am I got that kind of right?
I was just adding that, yeah. I mean, clearly, the difficult thing about giving the data to somebody else is that quite often, you know, you're taking the risk and they might get the benefit. I was pointing out that actually, you know, the more we get this partnership, this engagement, and the more we can get the proper constraints around the use of this data, you know, actually the benefits will come back to the individuals. And we've seen this in the 100,000 Genomes Program. There are people who, I don't know, some people in the room probably think rare diseases, well, they happen to somebody else, but there's a surprisingly high proportion of the population suffer. And my goodness, if you look at, you know, obviously the NHS is happy to bear this burden, but I've sat with people and heard stories about how they have been from clinic to clinic to clinic. One woman who was talking to me, you know, she'd had to give up her job because taking her child to try and get a diagnosis, and that information's shared with people who can show some light on what was wrong with her child, they now have a diagnosis. And that you know, it's not all science fiction. There's stuff that can have an impact now. That doesn't mean, you know, we put away all our concerns about data sharing, but there are benefits directly to the patients. This isn't entirely altruistic.
Thanks, Jim. Carol, if I could ask you, so one of the things I mentioned at the outset was the 2 years ago, the use of the care.data stuff. And that, presumably, I think Jim has opened up this question about who should have access and these questions about access. How do you think that all played? Should we think about who should have access?
I think that was a communication disaster, really. There's nothing wrong with sharing data. And in fact, what's the point of collecting data if you're not going to use it for something? But it's what it's being used for and who it's being shared with. So I think when patients speak to us, what they find is that they really struggle to get access to their own records. And they really struggle to get access from their GP, from the hospital. And they think, well, what's so secret within those records that can't be shared? But at the same time, you're coming back to me and you're saying, well, you want me to share lots and lots of detail about myself with some nebulous identities out there that we haven't really said. What are these pharmaceutical companies? You know, and it's how we tell people about what we're using. And it's exactly what you say. At what point do we consent and who do we consent? And I think at the outset, it should be laid out who you're able to consent to stuff to go to. Mm. And then if additional details are, you know, as your name or additional details are needed, then you can consent to particular research studies that you think might be relevant. But I think it has to be, you know, very clear what we're consenting to from the outset. And I think that's what the problem with care.data was.
Right. Do you think there's any limits in who should have access to our data?
Absolutely. And this is more personally, but also informed by what people tell me, is that the people with commercial interests, they're very worried about that. Mm. They're much more worried about that than, you know, if it's within a health research context that's non-commercial or within the National Health Service. I think there's a big divide there that people get worried about.
About, so by commercial interests, you mean?
Well, it could be any company that's looking to develop something.
Yeah. Federica.
Yes. I just wanted to follow up because that's a very important issue. I think we should be careful how we use language in the sense that the word sharing is not value-free, it's not, you know, neutral. When we talk about sharing, we think about, you know, dividing something with somebody else out of solidarity. And, you know, it is true, many of us are very willing to are really very willing to let people, researchers, use their data for research purposes that can help other people and themselves. But this is not, I mean, this is also a commercial initiative, and it is important rather than speaking about sharing, we should speak about accessing data. And several people have been saying this, that probably a better language would be explaining how data is made accessible, by whom, to whom, for which purposes. And I think clarifying this ambiguity and avoiding this ambiguity in language really can help also avoid you know, situations of public distrust, as the care.data case showed.
So you'd rather that we talk about it in terms of making data accessible rather than who has access?
Yes, and also, you know, talking about benefits, there are two types of benefits that we have been discussing here. One is the benefits of integrating data across care setting for care purposes. So this means that your hospital consultant will have access to your GP records, and you know, this is like integrating data. And another aspect is having researchers having access to your data for research purposes. So these are two different instances. And again, I wouldn't talk about sharing here. I would talk about accessibility to data, because, as Carol was saying, there are public institutes and there are commercial companies having access, which is not necessarily a bad thing, you know, but we have Google, IBM, pharma companies also doing research. So the question is, you know, who has access to it?
Great, thanks. You should hold on to that. So we have a couple of examples of the kinds of people for whom our data might not be acceptable to have our data accessible to them. I think the person who lives down the street and knows Jim is not happy for them to have access to his personal data. And as Carol's pointed out, there's this concern about commercial institutions. So any other views about this? What do we think about this? Yes, sir. If you just wait for the microphone to come. Thanks, Cora.
Seems to me, my name is Tony Williamson, it seems to me it's a tragedy that with all the information that the GP surgeries hold about our whole records, that when my wife has rushed in to the A&E, they know nothing. And at the same time, another relative of mine has some time ago been discovered to have tuberous sclerosis, which is a hereditary thing, I think. But clearly the knowledge about that was around for years and years before they discovered it. And my sister at my age had had epilepsy and things, which was obviously the beginning of it. And on the one hand, I feel that I want my information to be available for me. On the other hand, with my sister's family, I feel that I wonder whether were the information about her and her family available, whether they would have picked up this tuberous sclerosis thing a lot earlier, simply by being able to put two and two together and hopefully make four rather than five.
Would you be, just before, I mean, are there any limits, do you think, to who should have access to your and your family's data? Are you prepared to sort of draw the line anywhere?
I don't worry, personally. I've been in the public media for all my life, and I've never worried about people having my telephone number, email address, or what have you. But I appreciate some people do, and personally, I'm quite happy. I trust people. I think most people are of goodwill. There are a few crooks around, but I think most people are of goodwill, and personally, I'd prefer to take the risk.
Anybody else? Yeah.
Sorry, this is more of a data accessibility sharing controversy at the moment that I wanted to bring up just to see what you all think. As we speak, a tribunal is underway where Queen Mary, University of London, are appealing against the Information Commissioner's Office ruling that they must release anonymised patient data. The research in question is the £5 million publicly funded PACE trial from 2011, looking at potential treatments for myalgic encephalomyelitis or chronic fatigue syndrome. Dr. Richard Smith, ex-editor of the British Medical Journal, states that these researchers are defending the indefensible and that the inevitable conclusion is that they have something to hide. Respected scientists and doctors from around the world, including Stanford University, have stated there are major problems with the PACE trial's design and presentation of results, leading to seriously misleading claims about patient recovery rates. For example, I won't be long, a person could enter the trial with a physical function score of 65 out of 100, seen as severely disabled, deteriorate during the trial to 60 out of 100, yet still be classed as recovered. It is crucial that the data is subject to scrutiny and the true results are revealed, since this trial has had a huge influence worldwide on the way patients with ME/CFS are treated. My question is, how are patients and clinicians to trust healthcare recommendations if the data upon which they are based is purposely hidden?
So if I could summarise that, the problem is that the claim has been made that researchers won't disclose the data.
Yeah.
Now, are they claiming that this is because it's a breach of autonomy?
Well, the challenge is
that this is that they're falsified data or they're treating it corruptly. Is that?
Yes, I mean, they came up with saying that the requests were vexatious, even for requests from some scientists. Then they talked about keeping the privacy of individuals' data, and then that was seen to be absurd. Now, we don't know actually what they're doing. They're obviously paying these lawyers to appeal. We don't know what basis. I think they're worried that the other scientists, researchers, will twist the data their way. But we need to have a debate. Yes. We need everybody to be able to see the data.
You fancy having a go, Jim?
Now, this is really a question for Martin, but I'm going to kick off. If I will claim I don't have any sexual problems, but if I had engaged in a trial and I'd provided my sexual history to these researchers and I'd signed a consent form and they said, we're not going to give it to anybody, you might be right that an investigation is required here, but I do think there's a privacy issue. I wouldn't be very happy to have, oh, we're going to release all the patient level, the record level stuff so somebody can go through it. All that, you know, inherently, if somebody wished to, and if you want to validate it, you're going to have to go back to the individuals and their records. So I would caution you that I think there's a privacy piece around this that, you know, you might think ME's, you know, perhaps not so much of a stigma, but I don't know, I wouldn't.
That's why we need to get at the truth.
Okay, over to the professionals.
Okay, so one of the things I do for a living is to run clinical trials. I think the points you raise are really important. I know nothing about this particular case at all, and I can't comment, and my what I do say shouldn't be taken in the context of that trial because I know no details. I do think there are a number of issues that need to be considered. I think the very first one is what was the nature of the consent in the first place? Because I think in the context of clinical trials, almost without exception, a formal informed consent process approved by ethics committees and others is gone through. And it seems to me that then the primary responsibility from that point on is to uphold the terms of that consent. Now, there may be times that, like all privacy issue or any other issue, where some other allegation of crime, if you like, or of poor behaviour somehow overrides that. But I think the starting point should be the right of, that was put in the consent form in the first place. So that's step one. The second is that I think that there is a responsibility on the investigators, but there's a responsibility on researchers and the research community to produce results that are robust and reliable. And there's a responsibility to be able to defend that against allegations that they are otherwise. That exactly how one does that might depend on the circumstance and particularly on the first. So there are several ways of addressing the concern. One of which, for example, is to invite a second group of analysts, if you like, statisticians, to explore the data. There are also issues that you need to think about that is, where do you get that second group of analysts from? Do they actually understand all of the issues? Not all of which, it's not just a question of data, but it's also a question of how the whole study was conducted and so on. So there's a whole range of things. And do they have their own biases and other motives? I mean, I've no idea. So that's the second. And the third is, just to come back to data sharing as a general principle, is that privacy is beyond just anonymization. So it's not just, do I take the names and addresses out? In particular circumstances, then privacy also extends to, can you re-identify people from the data that you've got? Now, from genetics, it's sort of obvious, you imagine it's sort of obvious that you can, you pick up a genome and you can identify who it is because all of ours are more or less unique. Actually, in reality, that's quite hard. You see a genome walking down the street, you pick it up, and you can work out the sequence, but unless you've got some other context information and you behave badly, you can't do it. But the privacy issues are also still there, that re-identification is in theory possible, and that comes back to the consent issue at the very beginning. What was the understanding? So I think, you know, research should be reliable, robust, and defensible, and there should be mechanisms to allow that to happen. But the consent piece also needs to be upheld. That's why you got people in. That's why they trusted you to go into the study. And that, to my mind, is the primary consideration until such point as you can really outweigh that and argue that has to be overturned. The ethicists and the patient voice are on my left. I'd be interested in their view.
No, well, I also don't know anything about the case. Actually, I would like to hear more afterwards. I agree with the concerns that Martin raised in terms of consent. One issue that I would like to add is the aspect of context in doing research with large databases. And this is something that has been studied by several people doing like empirical studies showing how it is difficult to reuse data collected in a specific context with a specific research question or clinical goal in mind, which are two different things, and then reuse it for other type of research because some of that context gets lost. And so this is one of the issues that also have to be considered. So how reusable is the data is and what's the point of reaccessing it? Which is also one of the questions that have to be asked when that data is collected.
I think it's really difficult when you see, you expect medicine to be evidence-based, and then there's a question about the evidence base, and then someone is unwilling to share information about that evidence with you. often the initial reaction to that would be to then go, well, what are they hiding? But I have to say, I agree with the other end of the table that the initial consent that was given in a context for a reason. And so really that adding a secondary group of peer review to look at the data would probably be the best instance in that case. But as I said, I don't know anything about that situation either, but I can understand where the concern comes from, and I think that that's something that you would see in a lot of different cases, and particularly in a condition like ME where there's a lot of unknowns. So
Carol brought up this question about commercial institutions having access, I'm particularly interested if anybody has anything to say about that as a limit. But other than that, is there any other people have it? Yeah. Yep, just here. And then you.
Thank you. My name is Iveta Simera, and I run a program, it's called Equator, which helps researchers to share findings from their research projects, not only data, but through publications. And I think how I see this debate, we talk about data sharing, but what is important to say that there are different kinds of data, and as Mark suggests, sort of indicated, these comes with different type of information to be shared and different need for data protection. And one thing is access to our medical records, which are fully identifiable, and there are issues associated with this. And the other thing is access to data which come from research. And then again, you have different level of data. And those are slightly different issues, and there are different purposes what we share data for. So I think that's important to distinguish in debate, because you can't come up with one blank opinion or answer. You always have to link it to specific situation. And I think that hasn't been clarified enough for people to make up their mind. You can't say, are you for or against it? There's the context.
So thank you. So there are different kinds of data that are for different kinds of purposes. Martin, does that cause a problem for big data? If we're going to have different hurdles and different things to get over, then we can't use it all together and do wonderful things?
No, I don't think so. My perspective on this is that one needs to move away from a model in which we think about data ownership and data location, which is really now largely false, and more to one about purpose and control. So, and that includes the commercial interest. Most of the new treatments that we use have had commercial involvement in them at some point. And if we really want to know whether they work, we have to work with commerce in order to, with the commercial sector, in order to make sure that we understand whether they work. And it would be, I think, unwise to assume that somehow charity or government are going to pick up those enormous development costs. But one has to have the data sharing or data access with the relevant purpose and the relevant controls. For the sort of controls you want when your data, as somebody down here was saying, you know, the data that the GP has being shared with the hospital or the A&E department, that's for a particular purpose where you would anticipate a certain level of controls. You'd expect the data didn't get lost somewhere on the way, which of course is what happens to letters and other things. You'd expect those controls to be in place, and you'd expect that it didn't get into, generally speaking, the wrong hands, Jim's neighbour or whatever. That's one letter, purpose, one set of controls. For how can I compare the performance of this hospital's A&E or this patients with particular diseases in this hospital versus another hospital, that's another purpose with another set of controls. And I think as one moves along the line, it always comes back to, so why are we allowing those people to have access to the data? What's the purpose? What are they trying to do? And what are the controls? What are we saying they shouldn't do? And one of the big things that, by and large, people don't want to happen, in general terms, is to be re-identified. They don't want it coming home to roost to them. So the issue about sharing data with insurance companies, let's think about that for a moment. So insurance companies build models about what's likely to happen to all of us and how long we're going to live and whether we're worth the, you know, how much they're going to charge us for that particular bet that basically we'll never claim. That's how insurance companies work. And actually, if those models were better, that might actually have some overall advantage. And that can only be done on data, and they get their data, by and large, by the people who pay up to be part of those insurance companies. So I'm not arguing to share with data with the insurance companies, but I'm just using it as perhaps the most hostile and aggressive. If the models get better, then I don't have, personally, I don't have quite such a problem with that. If they then get used to penalise me, they re-identify me, and they don't only re-identify me, they re-identify you and penalise you, and they re-identify you and penalise you, then I have a problem, because they're stripping the data away, and having the purpose being learn something new, get a better model, you know, work out a better system, they've suddenly come down to something which is re-identifying people and then applying some sort of penalty or risk back to the person. So that re-identification is, I think, an important part of the control. And there are times when that re-identification is really helpful. So, for example, if you were doing genetic data and you took my genome and you were trying to study my rare genetic disorder, and then actually in order to need to do that, you actually emerged in lots of other people, and eventually, 10 years' time, you came back to me and said, you know what, we've discovered something new, we're going to re-identify you and tell you about it, that might be a good thing. So sometimes it might be helpful, and there are times when that re-identification can be really harmful. And that's a key part to me of the controls. But to go back to it, I think it's purpose and controls, not where does the data sit. If I ask any of you where actually are your emails, if I ask any of you where actually are your GP records, I think you'd probably be surprised what the answers are. They're not physically in your GP surgery. They're out there in computer servers sitting somewhere where you can actually identify them ultimately. But you know, it's not about location, it's about purpose.
Thank you. There's a question up here. Okay, sure. A bit further up.
Thank you. I'm a PhD student in the Wellcome Trust Center for Human Genetics. And I've got a question that's probably mainly for Jim, and it's related to one of the four key goals of Genomics England, I think, which is to kickstart a genomics industry in the UK. To do that, how feasible is it for very young companies that only consist of very few people and don't necessarily have a track record to actually get access to patient data, which is obviously very sensitive?
So this comes down to where is your data? And the second part, now Martin ended by reiterating purpose, which is, of course, it's part of, everyone's saying the same thing here, actually. They're talking about context. You know, and it is all relative. It isn't a yes-no answer. You know, is your data safe and secure is one of the questions we're looking at. And the question is, well, you know, relative to what? You know, how safe? Is it appropriate? What are the controls? Now, when we come to the Genomics England work, The approach that's been taken, and you can look at this as well for a lot of the way we manage the data for care, is quite a conservative, cautious one. That information, actually we do know where it is, and it's going to be on specific servers. You can think of it as in a private cloud, but a cloud that's utterly controlled and stays within England, as it happens. Now, you might think geography is irrelevant in the age of the internet, but it absolutely isn't when it comes down to governance and control. Martin talked about re-identification. If you're going to give people, whoever, you know, for whatever purpose, access to record-level data, so you've got specific pieces of information, then you are creating an opportunity, if they have enough related information about that individual, for them to re-identify. Now, you know, in my experience, most scientists don't have any interest whatsoever in re-identifying the subjects of their research. Now, maybe they should have more interest in those subjects, it's another debate, but they're not focused on that. That, of course, creates a risk, because they're not really watching the identification, de-identification. They're just saying, how can I do the science? Now, when we let people have access, and access is really what we should be thinking about. I quite like sharing, because you can think about oversharing, but access to this data. As the risks that come, as the value of these very detailed patient records and the genetic information increases, the amount of information about you increases, that increases the risks. But at the same time, the technology that's given us a chance to have this information in the first place has also given us the opportunity to manage it more securely. Because we can have more information about the researchers who are looking at it and what they do with it. So what we do with Genomics England is we have the data in a center and the researchers come to us. Now they come to us virtually, but every action they take, every access to the data, every piece of analysis is recorded. We can see who did what when. If you're going to give people that access, you can't completely eliminate the possibility of them re-identifying it. But if they do re-identify somebody and they attempt to take the fact of that re-identification out of our secure cloud, we'll have a record of them doing that, and they're going to be in trouble. And they're going to be in trouble because we have this governance framework around it. One example you might think of is Estonia. I don't know how many of you know even where Estonia is. It's a fantastic country. One interesting thing about it is all your data as an Estonian citizen is linked. Your tax records, your medical records, everything. And it's accessible, not to people at random, but it's possible that your local police commissioner can take a look. But the technology is there so that every access, every time somebody reads that, that fact has been recorded and accessible to the citizen. And you're looking for the legislation as well as the culture and the informatics to make this okay. So if you're caught looking at data and you haven't got a legitimate reason, you go to jail. I'm not saying we should send the bright young things of these startups to jail if they're found doing the wrong thing, but you've got to understand the seriousness by which when we let one of these little commercial companies, brilliant innovators, have access to the data, it's going to be under a heavyweight regime of, researchers need to take this very seriously. I'm sure you do. Now, that means that getting things up to speed means you don't... Somebody's got a brilliant idea. They've got a brilliant... Just let us at the data. We'll do stuff. Well, I think we're moving out of that era into a more serious... Well, okay, just as... If you know about the way medics access medical records, every access is recorded. Talking about EPRs, every access is recorded. We're going to be moving towards that for research data as well. When it's at that level of identified. Now, I know there's different levels of data and different, but if you're dealing with patient records in a research context, we have the same expectations about management. Now, getting there, ramping that up, means that if you're a small company and you want to come and have a look at this data, of course that's part of the goal. But we're not just going to say, look, here's a spreadsheet. And it takes a while to get all of this infrastructure up and running. That's the intention, but you've got to get this extra layer of management around it. Sorry, that was a bit of a long answer.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks very much. So, if I could just summarise that, the idea is that security, safety and security is monitored in the same way as the users are monitored. So we can monitor what the users are doing with it as well. And that seems like an interesting sort of thing. I'll come to you in just a second. I just want to get Federica's comments on those sorts of security and safety issues.
Yes, thank you. I think there are several aspects to it, and one is definitely the aspect of transparency of who has access, and as you rightly said, technology on the one hand is the problem and on the other hand could help with the solution, but it's not only the technology, it's the way we, the governance mechanisms that we have around it. Another point that I wanted to make is what is important is also not only to know who has access, but also, again, talking about governance mechanisms, how do we, what are the criteria to give access? And one point that I think it's important, it's not only about who can pay to have access, because, if we talk about small and medium enterprises and companies, it is important that it's not only Google or big pharma or, who have access to this data. And then it's a matter, again, that's why I'm saying it's a matter of governing. It's, of course, you have the technical mechanisms for that, but then you also have to think about we have to think about governance mechanisms.
Mm. Gentleman here in the, fifth row.
I think to solve this problem, we've got to address some of these issues of concerns by the by the patients, by the users. This is not helped by the way the insurance industry has behaved. Insurance was originally supposed to be, we're all in it together, and if you're unfortunate to have an accident, you get sorted out. That's what the old mutual societies were supposed to be. But insurance companies are going to this very selective process that if you fit a particular profile, you get an insurance cost at half. And some people end up with uninsurable houses and uninsurable lives and so on. It's also not helped, I suggest, by the government allowing local authorities to sell the electoral roll. Admittedly, if you remember to tick the box that says your data won't be included, if you even realise you can do that, you can be kept out of it. But I think there's a big problem with perception here, not helped, of course, by the hacking scene, that people don't understand that actually those examples that have given big publicity are probably a tiny, tiny fraction of what's going on.
Mm.
What does the panel think about those issues?
Jim?
I'm going to be cheeky. I think, you know, you're absolutely right. I'm not that worried about the local authority and the electoral roll. What worries me, and this is why, this is where you start moving out of the informatics being an obvious, the main part of the solution. Don't underestimate the need for new technology to help you actually impose these governance frameworks. But the culture, the legislation, the ethics around this, we're only just starting to realize the need for some of it. I don't tell my GP a lot. If you got my GP record, you'd find out a few embarrassing things about me, but not that much. But if I think there's something wrong with me, I might Google for it. Google know which devices I have, or at least they have the ability to know exactly where I live, they know my friends are, they know, you know, I think, you know, worrying about the electoral roll in the council is only part of it. We're looking for something of a revolution in how we manage data. And how we constrain this. And I think, so it's more the other people.
I just wanted to jump in because it's interesting to me that, you know, what is it about our health records that we're so concerned about? Because if you think about some of the places we willingly give a lot of data to, for example, your Nectar card, that gives so much information to commercial companies about your lifestyle, about some of your diet, some of your health, therefore, perhaps, potentially. And then you also have things like Fitbit. So we are actually sharing a lot of data willingly without thinking about it. So what's interesting to me, is it because of the chance that it goes to insurance companies? Is it about the fact that there is some kind of crux of who we are within our medical data that makes people additionally concerned? And in a way, isn't it nice that the medical community is actually entering into these debates and looking at the ethics, whereas some of the other organizations that seem as though it'd be fine to share information with have just collected your data without really telling you?
Mm. I wanted to, Carol, before we put that down, I wanted to move on, because this issue of what we know about what's being collected and what's being used in what way, as Martin's already spoken about it, this question about consent, that was a lot of the big issue in the care.data scandal. And part of that was about people not knowing. And one of the solutions to that was this idea about opting in and opting out. I mean, did you have any thoughts about that and whether or not that sort of model might apply in this kind of case?
Before you can opt in or opt out, you have to understand what you're opting in and opting out of. And I think with care.data, that wasn't clear because it was so poorly communicated. People didn't really understand what their information was going to be used. In a way, do we understand what is our medical record? So are you giving away blood pressure data? Are you giving away my date of birth? What is it that you're telling people? So I think we need to actually have the debate at a level where people, you know, can engage with it. And I don't think that happened with care.data. It was just, oh, you know, of course we'd want to send that off. You'll help save lives. And if you don't, oh, that's a bit, you know, naughty. And that's kind of the level it seemed to come across to a lot of patients. We had a debate about care.data before, and a lot of the concerns were, you know, I don't know where this is going. I don't know what it's for. And, you know, previous experience, perhaps, of seeing large data sets end up on trains by ministers might make people worry about what happens. And
So how do you think we get around that? I mean, how do we make the public and patients understand the sorts of things that Martin wants to do with the data?
I think you have to understand that there's a level of health literacy of the public that is different from the medical community, and I think you need to communicate at the level of literacy that people are at. So you need to explain things in a way that they can understand, and it is a different language, and there's a lot of jargon when it comes to that, medical records and data, and there are a lot of people who are really clued up because they've spent a lot of time in the system, you know, working on it, and they know, but there are also a lot of people, myself, for example, who have never been in a hospital, you know, other than to go speak to patients, but, you know, for a medical reason. And so maybe perhaps I don't have the knowledge or the terminology or the understanding of what you might even collect and what you might hold on me at all. So I think it's making sure that we have a debate that's clear and open and so people know what they're getting into, and then to leave the decision to them ultimately and to, you know, extol the benefits.
Federica.
Thanks. I agree that we need to, that information has to be clearly communicated, but I don't think it's only a matter of health literacy, although I agree it's very important, but it is a matter, and the point has been raised, we are also very often talking about data in general, and as we said, there are different types and different uses. And, you know, one of the dilemma is to, I mean, how to, you know, how to, it's a matter of a balance between, on the one hand, recognizing that there are different purposes and making clear what these purposes are. But on the other hand, we don't want to have specific consent for one specific purpose, because then research becomes impossible. There is no point to have so much data if then you can, you know, you cannot all these databases can be used by other researchers. So this is really hard, and as has been pointed out, we are, you know, starting lagging behind a little bit, resonating about novel ways of governing and novel ways maybe informed consent. Some authors said, well, that's not the way to go. We should think about other mechanisms. And, well, I know I don't have an ultimate solution for that. But what I'm saying is, I don't think it's only a matter that it was communicated badly in a difficult way for the public, although I agree with that. But that's only part of the problem. The other problem is that it was unclear how this data would be used and what was it. Not because it was a difficult language, but because we are still struggling with how to do it.
I think there's also a bit of a quid pro quo. You know, the UK holds one of the largest data set of patient experience data in the world in the National Survey Programme. They question 80,000 patients a year about their experience in hospital. And over the last 10 years of that programme, they have very effectively managed the status quo. And there are about 5 changes in patient experience that have occurred in those 10 years, and they have been entirely transactional. So people have got more letters on time, hospitals have become a bit cleaner, and people have got more written instructions about what to do with their medications. People haven't become nicer to patients. People have not learnt to communicate better with patients. And I think, it's this idea that patients have often willingly given information and then seen nothing happen from it, and no material benefit from having given that information. So perhaps if we were to do a little bit more with some of the information that we hold of patients and actually give some benefit, they might be more willing to share their data.
Mm. Thank you. We need to get some last comments, that's right. Martin, could I get you to say something briefly about this consent issue?
Yes, I think the first is to think at which point you draw the line for consent. I think my one word on care.data would be disaster. You couldn't have done it more badly. But I think there are two pieces. One is, how can you join the data together? And putting barriers in the way of being able to join the data together is incredibly unhelpful and damaging, whether it's from the GP to primary care, or it's across hospitals. Because if one puts the consent barrier at the point of, I don't want the data to leave X, first of all, you can never do sensible things that you should do at scale, like what are the rates of survival from breast cancer surgery across all the surgeons in the UK. You just can't do it because the worst surgeons won't put their data in. So those are the sort of things you have to be able to join the data. So the data have to move to allow that sort of stuff to happen. The second is I'm always really worried about imposing consent models which might disadvantage the most needy. I think it's quite easy to come up with consent models that satisfy, that are overly interpreted or applied, which might serve many of those who contribute to the development of those models, and I'm looking around, that includes the people in the room, but which might not serve the most needy. If one thinks about those whose English is not their first language, who are not haven't got either great literacy, let alone health literacy, those who are immigrant populations, those who've got mental health issues, the list goes on and on. That actually, if one puts in, and you have to sign a consent form in the first place in order to be able to do something sensible, that's really unhelpful and I think damaging to individuals' health. And then I think at the last moment, the question becomes around transparency. There are some really good things, the health survey data is an example, but there are lots of other really good things that come out of sharing the data and bringing it together. And we need to make much more of that. And my experience from research projects, big research projects, has been when patients or participants see the value of what they've contributed. They only see the data, they need to see the value of what's been contributed. Come back, here is a new finding, here is a new treatment, here is something new that's happened, here is a new project that's going across because of your participation. That actually people have found is really rewarding. And I would keep the consent piece, but I would keep it for specialist circumstances, and that's still a lot, but I think you have to get to a point where you can actually bring data together and do many of the really sensible and I think largely essential things that need to happen.
Great, thanks very much. I need to bring this to a close. We have important people speaking shortly. More important people, if you can believe that. But what I'd like each of our panellists to do is to give us a sentence or two about what we've been talking about. But I think with particular focus on that learning the lessons from care.data for research in the future in Oxfordshire. Jim, we start with you, just because you're there.
Thank you. Just because I'm here, we need. So I just think Martin's put it very nicely. Actually, we need more data sharing, better data sharing, and we need more controls. And we need more investment in those controls, not just to stop the data moving from A to B when it shouldn't, but also to make sure that when it turns up in a different context in a different setting, it's properly understood, it's properly used, and that we have this feedback, this transparency, so we understand what's going on.
Martin.
We have a duty to learn from everything we do in medicine. The use of data is no exception to that. But we also have a responsibility to do so in a way that respects the patients and the public who contribute to that. And that is a two-way responsibility. One is looking after whatever it is that you entrust us with. And the second is using it to the best of our abilities to give new information and reliable information back. And it's a two-sided coin. Both elements are important.
Federica?
Well, I'd make the point again that we need to move beyond the sharing metaphor and the moral connotations that come with it and really understand that we're talking about access and what that means. And that we need to be creative in thinking about governance mechanisms that have to be in place and that can help dealing with this.
Mm. Great, thanks. Carol?
I think once you've sorted out the governance and the sharing protocols, you should figure out how to get those records between organizations that people might need to attend as well. So it should be, it's not just kind of research versus the everyday. I think we need to learn the lessons in terms of sharing things within hospital wards, for example. Mm.
Great, thank you very much. Thank you much for coming along and for your questions and attention. Enjoy the rest of the open day. Thank you again. Can you join me in thanking the panel? Thank you.